and they still come out to hear me.
Yeah, and I can remember too when I was principal of the school and he came, I kind of got a bit uninterested in what I was meant to be doing. I used to sit through some of his sessions as well. Okay, so we're together for 40 minutes, we better get cracking. And we've known each other a while, Jeff, but there's a lot of people here tonight who will make reference to a bit later who've known him a lot longer than I have. But do you want to start giving a bit of a potted history of your life? I mean, you talk a little bit about it in the introduction to the opening, the windows to catch the sea breeze, but do you want to tell people a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, shall I do that poetically or shall I...
Let's start with a
poem and... Yep. I think I can, you know, best explain myself by these poems. This poem is called The Accent. I grew up in Adelaide in the 50s, when the spoken word counted, when neighbours knew one another by name, when you didn't lock your doors. I lived in a street where men were called Bluey, and Hooker, and Hornblower, and The Rock, and Doc, and Pop, and Gorilla, and other nicknames. And it didn't matter that you couldn't find them in the phone book, because most of them didn't have a phone. I lived through an era of 6 o'clock closing, where the drunks bus would often bring the old man home at half past. Unless, of course, he was two elephants drunk to climb the steps. And then it was a yellow cab, and we'd carry him inside in a bucket. And some nights, through those times, the fireworks started well before the 5th of November. But I enjoyed those days and nights when television hadn't yet arrived, listening to the old man sing Sweet Molly Malone and Irish Eyes Are Smiling, and that he couldn't sing mattered little. Or he might have read us a poem from around the Boree Log, in an accent somewhat like his grandparents bought from County Cork, while we four kids giggled and nudged one another to get closer to the fire. On Sundays, I'd listen to the Mass in Latin at 8 o'clock, at least for a while, and knew when the priest was going to say, Dominus Foribus Cum, Kyrie Eleison, or Christe Eleison. And I always loved the sound of those words, yet I never knew their meanings. But it was the theatre, the costumes, and the powerful performances that drew me in. We kids were lucky to live with poetry through those years. The old man was always obscure. He'd use his household language, but always in an unconventional way. He'd say, put the wood in the hole. And if you didn't twig or didn't move, he'd add, listen, opium, were you born in a tent? And he'd keep on giving his clues until we woke. We seldom slept. Thank you. And I could launch into Copley Street, I think, straight away. And,
yeah, well, you've got
a And it's great that there are a couple of residents, former residents from Copley Street here. We've got Bev Henderson in the front row, almost the front row, and Peter Hand almost in the back row. People that I've known all of my life. I moved into the street at 9 months of age, and Peter would be my oldest living friend. We've been playing together since we were in nappies. But Copley Street was an unusual place to grow up in. It was a street full of very different people. It was a different era, of course, and this poem, I think, explains it reasonably well. It all happened in Copley Street. I grew up in the 50s in Copley Street at Broadview, and up until my youth, I'm sure that I had tunnel vision, thinking each and every street and suburb must have been the same. I lived with my mum and dad, my sister and two brothers, in a red brick house with a tiled roof and a paling fence. In fact, everyone in Copley Street had a red brick house with a tiled roof and a paling fence. Not to mention medals that got pinned to proud chests on Anzac Day. And everyone in Copley Street had a war service home and a war service loan that ran at 4.5%. And most would put their hands up to show an even lower interest in the Liberal governments of the day. And most, although perhaps not all, paid dearly over time to qualify for that rate. In our household, we learned early on about Pig Iron Bob and about how things come back to haunt us. And Honest Tom too. We knew how he looked after us, gave all us kids a bottle of lukewarm milk to drink each day for fronting up to school. Weren't we lucky? And weren't our teachers lucky too? Lucky to have less than 42 a class. Yeah, and even then we knew our class. And not just from the sour milk in the summer. Back in Copley Street we had reds on our beds and nothing to hide. We had nowhere to go. That was back in the good old days. Stuck out the northern suburbs on an unmade road with piss poor public transport. Yeah, they were the days. They were the good old days. Days when your old man could still show you what a shrapnel scar looked like, or even let you feel a bit that they'd missed. Or nights when your old man woke screaming and raging, when youth could cover under the blankets, and Vietnam still to come. Yeah, wasn't that something to look forward to? Yeah, the good old days. Those days when you'd either swelter or freeze in those outmoded temporary classrooms of local tech, where half your teachers wore RSL badges and were just as neurotic as most of your fathers, and keen as muscles to punch them into the classroom or try to pin you to the wall of the woodwork room with a chisel or nail you with a flying mallet. Yeah, they were the days. They were the good old days. When you left school at 15, undereducated yet still knowing too much, going out in the big wide world with bill cream in your hair, strutting your stuff in your stovepipe pants and your pointy shoes, your shirt collar turned up to overstate your politics, only to get dragged down a laneway and belted by the anti-larrikin squad because honest Tom said he'd have the police clean up all the bodgies and widgies. Yeah, they were the days. It was always a class act, the way those coppers worked. Yeah, they were the days. Most of those red brick houses have been painted now. Their tiled roofs resprayed too. And the paling fences went long ago, helped along by kids who made them into makeshift guns to play their war games with before they knew. Most of those original men from Copley Street are dead now, and some of the women too. And those who are left grow old and frail. When things get tough for me today, I think back to the good old days, and I always look forward to tomorrow.
So I reckon, Jeff, people might be interested. I mean, I know a reasonable amount about you. I've known you for a fair while now, but what lingering effect do you think that your upbringing and your working class background's had on you?
Well, if I didn't have that background, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Has you know, marked me indelibly, I think. I think the experience of that upbringing has been the basis of my work, and writing about my life has allowed me to perhaps understand it a little bit more, but not just understand myself, understand who I've come from.
When I read your poetry, I feel too that there's a lot of things there that you found that were tough at the time, but there's a sense of pride in what in your family and what that represented.
We were always taught to carry our head high. We were brought up not to run away from anyone. We were brought up with a punch mentality, which the old man, you know, rejected by the time that he died on his deathbed. He said to me, the worst thing I ever did with you bastards was teach you how to fight. He said, you've all got pinched by the coppers for assaulting police, you know. He said, you've learned the power of language. He said, and the power of language now is in your poetry. And he said, that's the greatest thing that could have happened to you. He said, to move away from the way that I brought you up. And, you know, I have to agree with him. That there is a lot of power in the ordinary, everyday, simple language that people use day in and day out. And we shouldn't be embarrassed about our pasts. I'm not. I'm proud of where I come from. And I can see Peter up the back nodding his head and Beth nodding her head, and we grew up in very similar houses and under very similar conditions and circumstances. They were tough days, but they were great days.
Do you think your dad was pretty badly affected by his war experiences, Jeff?
Oh, for sure. He had, you know, bits of shrapnel still in his head, and you know, he used to say that he was bomb happy when we were kids. In 1992, we found out he had post-traumatic stress disorder. They found a name for it, but it took a long bloody time to do that. And I think his nightmares and his drinking to excess was all brought about by that being a rat of Tobruk and copping a lot of shrapnel.
We were talking earlier too about Jeff's mentioned sometimes that there was some pretty physical behaviour by teachers in that era too, and do you think that some of them might have been in a similar situation?
Oh, some of them were undoubtedly a killer. There were three or four that had Mr. Leg was one, and I punched on with Mr. Leg for a while, but Mr. Leg grabbed me by the shoulders, he dragged me out into the corridors, and they used to have the lockers with the brass handles, and he bounced me off the brass handles about six times and quieted me down. But I took a bit of quietening down at times, you know. I punched on with a few of the teachers, and not just the teachers but the students as well, of course. I went to Adelaide Boys Technical High School on the corner of North Terrace and Frome Road, where the University of South Australia is now, but I was told after 12 months there that I wouldn't be re-enrolled, that I needed to go to a local technical high school. So they said, we won't expel you, but we'll send you on your way. If we expel you, you'll never get into another school. But when Nasworth Tech closed, one of the women that worked there pulled out my VG form, which had, and also gave me the letter that had been sent by Mr. Cannell, the headmaster at Adelaide Boys, that just bagged the guts out of me and set me up for the slide to the bottom of the academic pecking order that I had at Nasworth Tech. And it was very difficult because I had people like Peter Hand to compete with, and we were both fighting to see who was going to come bottom. Not to say that some good people didn't come out of that school, they did, and I acknowledge that too. And I acknowledge that I went to Hampstead Primary School, and I went with Theo Maris, who owns half the east end of Adelaide now, Roger Drake, listed in the 250 richest men in Australia, coming in at 232. Grant Purdy, head of neurology, Queen Elizabeth Hospital. There was a lot of talent come out of that area, out of that working class area, and I think it's I was lucky to live there, and lucky to have those long-standing friendships with those people that I've mentioned too.
Yeah, well, I guess in a sense, I know some people tend to think that if that your social background determines your intelligence and whatever, but I think the story you've just told is that that's not in fact the reality, is it? It's a lot more to do with opportunity and whatever. Do you think there was also a different view of masculinity in those days, Jeff, in the era that you and I were brought up in?
Oh, I think so. The old man got down the knees and taught us how to fight when we were very young, because it was a tough suburb and you had to be able to fight in that suburb to survive. And perhaps I'll read this poem to your three sons, which is my father's voice coming at you through the poem to your three sons. You said, everyone loves a larrikin, no one loves a lair, especially a mug lair. You taught us when to shut up and when to shape up, but you taught us too when to pull our heads in. You said, you've got to back your judgment, some mugs. You've got to be able to back it up too. You said, you might cop the occasional hiding, but you don't run. It doesn't matter how big they are. You said, you run once and you run for the rest of your lives. And you said, and this is what you use. And you held up your fist. You said, you don't use an Aristotle and you don't use a monkey's ass. They're for drop kick and punts. You've got these, learn to use them. They might come in handy. Then you got down on your knees on the kitchen lino. You showed us how to tuck the chin into the shoulder, how to hold the elbows into the ribs, how to swivel from the waist, how to keep the mitts up. You told us to lead with the left. You told us we weren't going to knock them out with that one. You told us the left jab to use to put the head in the right spot. Then we could knock them out. John, you weren't far wrong. And of course, you don't have to be far out to be wrong. You know, 360 degrees in a circle, but if you spin 359, you're wrong. You might be a cigarette paper thickness away from being right, but you're wrong.
The ones you've read, Jeff, have been from Poems for a Dead Father, and I think that won the Age Book. It was shortlisted for the Age Book of the Year 2000.
It was, yeah,
early
shortlisted.
Was that a big surprise to you?
It was an enormous surprise. It was the last thing in the world that I expected it. and was the highlight of my career to that point, getting that shortlisting. I didn't win, but I didn't anticipate that I would win when I got the shortlisting either.
Yep.
But the book was a great success, and the reviews for that book were absolutely fabulous.
A lot of your books have had to be reprinted.
Multiple runs. I did a tally yesterday, and I reckon sold 43,500 books over the course of my 35-year career now, which is not much if you're a novelist, but for a poet, you know, like this book came out in a print run of 2,500. I reckon there might be 100 left. There's none of that. No Collars, No Cuffs, the first book printed 9 times. Bow Tie and Tails 4 times. No Ticket, No Start, the Book of Poetry from the Building Sites, 5,000 the first print run. Sold out in 7 months, immediate reprint. You'll find a copy now if you go to a second-hand joint, but that's about it. You know, so they're good figures, but for my whole career, what I've tried to do is take poetry to people that might normally not buy poetry. Like, I stopped work on every major building and construction site in 1990 and read poetry to building workers. You know, everyone sort of said, oh, you'll never make that work. I said, fucking watch me. And I jumped up and did it. And, you know, I got hecklers, but I shut the hecklers up pretty quick. And I always had backstops in the audience who would help me shut the hecklers up too. Because they'd had a gutful of them. You know, they knew them, that worked well. Then I went out into factories, and I worked in factories, and I thought that was going to be a piece of cake too, but that was entirely different, because building workers and factory workers are two entirely different cultures. Building workers are very verbal people. They're physical people, and they're confident people. Factory workers would come in to hear me. They would look at the grey carpet. They would have an occasional glance at me. They would never heckle me. They would never applaud me. They would never question me. They would never do anything. Well, after a few of these readings, I said to the union organiser that was getting me in, like, you've got the wrong man. These people don't like me. And he said, they love you, mate, you know. They're ringing us up afterwards and saying, bring the bloke back. And I said, but they don't talk to me. They don't communicate. He said, they don't communicate with anyone. And I thought, you know, these blokes go to work. They put on the earmuffs, they put on the safety goggles, they put on the leather gloves, they stand at the machine and make parts and put them in the bale, and the noise is so deafening. You walk up and down, I started going through those factories, and the noise would resound through your chest. And I thought, you know, what a way to work. And then an orange light would flash and everyone would hit the red button. They'd go into the smoko shed and I'd read poetry to them. But, if they just went to the smoko shed for lunch, what you're going to hear is this. The hum of the air conditioner. You might hear the fall of cards when they're playing cards, because if Steve throws two out, I know he wants two back, and Royce throws three out and he wants three back, and Jess nods her head and I know she's sitting pat. So you don't need to communicate if you're playing cards.
Geoffrey, some might say that's the sound of Australian males communicating.
Yeah, exactly.
I get you to have a... We were talking about the workforce poetry. Would you mind reading poetry in the workforce? Would you mind reading that?
Yeah,
you can lay your hand on that. So I think it's on page 62. So Geoffrey's career, I haven't ever seen him in the building sites and the factories, but I've seen a lot of him in the schools, and there was never any... He never had that problem there of kids and teachers who were with him thinking that they weren't interested in it. They always were.
Yeah, they were. And, I mean, we've got a couple of prime examples here tonight. Sitting in the front row, Stephen Brock, Dr. Brock. Dr. Brock, you know, first heard me at Marion High School. And then later I'd see him wandering through the market at around about... And then he came to me at the All Right Writers Festival for Come Out. And he was, you know, one of the little boys that jumped on the train and came down to Port Adelaide every day. And at around about age 19 or 20, I spotted him at the market and I said, you're still writing a bit of poetry, come to the cargo club with me. Which then, you know, had 150 people on a Monday night. And we got down there and I got him up on the stage and he knocked him dead there. And he's published a few books. Sitting behind him, Emma McEwen. Emma is an old girl of Pembroke. And... I met Emma when she was 15 years of age, when she was a young year 10 girl. Emma has published several books and works as an academic and very bright girl. You know, they listened and we still talk. So I couldn't be all that bad.
Geoffrey, I explained to you...
Shut up, Gary, smile.
<Go on. laughs> I explained to you earlier that I went looking for your books last night because I've got all of them and none of them are there. I suspect my kids have hooked them all, so
yeah,
they read them, certainly.
Well, a lot of bookshops don't like stocking my books because they're so often stolen. But it's a great backhanded compliment, you know.
Well, clearly, a lot of your mates are reading books, Geoffrey, clearly.
Well, I can tell you now that I sold a lot of books in the Yatla Jar when I was a writer in residence there, but I went back there at one stage and there wasn't any of my books left because they'd cut the back page out. And I sold that before they left so that it didn't, set off any alarms. And the same has happened in the resident jail in Hobart. So, you know, it's nice to get those sort of compliments. But anyway, I digress. I was going to give you poetry in the workplace. In 1990, I stopped work in every building and construction site in Australia. I launched the project on Theo Maris's site on Hindmarsh Square. It was a sensational launch, but the following day, front page story, Lindsay Thompson, the general manager of the South Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, has slagged the guts out of me and said that I would make Australia the laughing stock of the world and that they had their chance to learn poetry at school. And all I wanted to do was leave the union office, go down there and belt him. And I thought, well, I can't do that. I'm going to get locked up. And I thought, what can I do? And I thought, I can give him a belting. So I said to Benny Carslake, who was then the union secretary, I'm going home so that I got some quiet. I need to put this bloke in his place. I got home, I wrote this poem, I got on the phone, I rang ABC Radio. It went on ABC Local, it then went on Radio National, it went right around Australia. It then appeared on the back page of the Financial Review. It appeared in the Melbourne Age. Lindsay Thompson gave me the biggest career boost that anyone has ever given anyone. I can give you the drum on that. So here it is, Poetry in the Workplace for Lindsay Thompson, General Manager, South Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry. They had their chance to learn poetry at school, he said. It's a bit late now, but Mr. Thompson's talking out of school. His standard's measured by dollars, not cents. From Enterprise House on Leafy Greenhill Road, you can bet he'd be well-versed. He'd know the 100% write-off for removing asbestos from outdated public buildings. But as for blue asbestos claims, it's a bit late now. And maybe Mr. Thompson knows a sonnet has just 14 lines. But would Mr. Thompson know the weight of workers' steel-capped boots? Or just that weight of coin required to replace a pair? And would Mr. Thompson know how families deal with death when a scaffolder takes a dive? Would Mr. Thompson then respond to a union call for increased safety? Or would Mr. Thompson simply say, it's a bit late now?
Yeah.
Well, that poem shut Lindsay up good and proper. We never heard another Dickie Bird from Lindsay.
Geoffrey, in your selected poems, you've written a section in the introduction to it about explaining what you were doing when you wrote the poems. Could you explain why you did that?
Why?
Why you explained what you were doing at the time? What sort of the genesis of the poem?
Well, it's him bagging me and saying they had their chance to learn poetry at school and it's a bit late now. And they quote him in the advertiser saying those things. And I thought, it's a bit late now. I started writing poetry when I was 33 years of age. I didn't have a chance to learn poetry at school because I didn't give myself that chance. And I thought poetry was for poofs and sucks and fags and fairies because, you know, I was too tough for that, you know. I'd never been shown a book whilst I was at school that vaguely resembled the lifestyle that we lived. They just weren't there. And it wasn't until I'd hurt my back, I knew that I couldn't work again. I was crawling around on my hands and knees at home and I crawled over a book that had been left lying on the floor by one of my sons who was lying face down. I flipped it over and saw it was poetry. I thought, poetry, I'm too tough to read poetry. And I thought, no bastard will see me, I'll read it. So I took the book to bed. I read it from cover to cover and after reading it once, I thought, shit, I reckon I could write this sort of stuff myself. I thought, no, I'm an idiot, I'm a half-wit, I know that because I've been told that.
Yeah.
And I thought, maybe those teachers were wrong, maybe I can have a crack at it. And I thought, the only way I'll find out if I can do it is to have a crack at it. So I grabbed a pad and a pen and I started to write. Now, if I'm to look back on those first poems that I wrote, they are fairly dreadful poems, and I'll be the first to put my hand up for that. If I want to look back on them, I can, because I've sold them all to the Australian Defence Force Academy in Canberra, and they're now kept in their manuscript collection, where they have been accessed by a university student who was writing her PhD thesis on working class poetry. So that's nice too. But that's what got me started, and I became a reader. And you can't be a writer without being a reader. And I read an awful lot of stuff. I don't like an awful lot of poetry that I read, but I still force feed myself to read people to the point until I get bored and then I stop. But I want to hear those other voices other than my own. I don't want to hear just my own voice.
So what do you think you've gotten out of writing poetry, Jeffrey? I mean, some writers talk about it as being a cathartic experience. Do you see it that way?
I think it is. I think that I've understood myself a lot more by writing about my life. It makes you think not just from your own perspective, but from the perspective of perhaps the person on the other side of the coin that is out there that you're challenging. And and you know, writing has given me a lifestyle too. You know, I've been around the world from it. I've lived off the proceeds of poetry. When I went to the SACAE at Underdale in 1984 as a mature age student, and after 6 weeks I knew that I didn't belong there, that I was wasting my time. And I thought, if I chuck it in now, my kids are going to think I'm a doughy. And I thought, I'll stay for the year and I'll get the best results I can. So I stayed for the year. I got 7 distinctions out of the 9 subjects, and then I told them I was going to chuck it in, and they said, well, don't just chuck it in, defer, and then we can use your results because you're our best student. And so I deferred, and they said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to work as a poet. And they said, oh, you won't live off that. And I said, hey, fucking watch me. And you know, I have, and I've had a pretty good life.
Jeff, I saw a story once that you met Ken Kesey, and he made that comment to you, something similar. Ken Kesey,
yeah,
who wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I believe, said to you that, well, if you're going to make a living out of writing, write novels, you're never going to survive on poetry. Is that right?
Yeah, he came up to me at Writers Week. He was one of the first people to buy my first book, No Collars, No Cuffs. And the following day, I saw him again, and he said, hey, guy, he said, I love that book, goddamn. He said, I've been in this country for a couple of weeks now. He said, I heard a lot of writers. He said, but I haven't heard any Australian writers until I heard you. He said, all the others sound like they could have come from Britain or Canada or America or anywhere else. He said, but we know where you come from the language that you're using. He said, what are you going to do now? And I said, I'm going over that tent to hear a bit more poetry. He said, no, I mean, what are you going to do with your career? I says, well, fucking write another book, I suppose. And he said, don't fuck with the poetry, otherwise you're going to be living in a trailer when you're 60. Well, I'm a renter. I'm fucking nearly 70. I wasn't far off the mark. I'll give you the drum. He said, you've got to write a goddamn novel. And I said, I haven't got to do me to write a novel. And he said, of course you can. He said, you come to the States, I'll show you. I said, yeah, I'll just fucking grow wings and fly over there, will I? And he said, things will change for you. He said, don't worry about that. Anyway, 12 months later, I rang him up and I said, things have changed. You know, like, I'm coming over, bringing a bride with me. And he said, well, there are plenty of women here. He said, as you wish. Anyway, I went and stayed for a couple of weeks with Ken Kesey. We did a two-man reading together in Eugene, Oregon. They had to get the police there to remove people from the premises. There were so many people in the building that they wouldn't let the poetry reading start. They were towing cars away that were parked outside. And it was a sensational night, and then he set me up with other people around America. You know, he was pretty right. You know, I probably should have written a novel. I haven't. I've written almost a book of short stories, and Michael, every time I look at him, he asks me, where's that manuscript of short stories? So perhaps I should read a short story.
Yeah, if you like, yeah.
And again, this short story explains a little bit of where I come from too. It's called Hamming It Up. It was a Sunday morning in 1956, and we just got home from 8 a.m. Mass. I changed out of my good clothes and put on a pair of shorts, a t-shirt and my school sandals. Mum and Dad were drinking a pot of tea in the kitchen and reading the paper when I walked out the back door, careful not to let the screen door slam. It was already quite warm and the backyard with all its fruit trees seemed a cooler place to be. Besides that, whilst I'd been kneeling down that morning, not understanding any of the Latin Father Killian was using, I'd been thinking about the one pizza was still left up on the tree. I'd spotted it when I was in the chook shed getting the eggs before church. It was high up and was going to be hard to get, but it didn't look as though the birds had beaten me to it. I dragged an empty banana box out of the shed, across the yard, then upended it below the peach tree. It was a white peach, its fruit really fleshy and juicy with smooth and furry skin, dusted with tinges of soft pink. This last one looked like the best one too. I got the yard broom out of the shed and climbed on top of the box. I pushed the broom head up through a tangle of branches to try and tap it gently so it might drop. I knew I'd have to be quick then to catch it without falling off the box and hurting myself. But I was just a little bit too short to reach it. If the box had been 6 inches higher, I could have got it for sure. My best chance now is to scale the tree on one of the biggest branches and try to reach out for it. I just started to get really close when I heard the slap of the screen door closing. Then Dad's voice yelling out, "Jeff, where are you?" "Up here," I replied, but he could hardly see me because the apricot and the nectarin trees were between us. I could see him though, but I was fairly high up and I could see he was looking for me on the ground. "I'm up in the peach tree," I yelled. "What the bloody hell are you doing up there?" "There's one peach left and I'm trying to get it," I explained. He wandered down and got directly underneath me. "You hop down, I'll get the ladder and get it for you. Now come on, hop down before you fall down." By the time I climbed down, he was back with a wooden stepladder and started to position it so it was really steady. He asked me to stand side onto the ladder and hold onto it with both hands. He had to get right up on the very top step too, and I could feel the ladder start to rock a little bit. He must have felt it too because he said, "You keep a firm hold and I don't want to go arse up." "I've got it," I said, and tightened my grip a bit more. "I've got it too," he said, "and it's a bloody beauty." And then he started to descend. When he got back down, he passed it to me. It was perfect, apart from one little spot where a bird had stuck its beak in for a taste. That didn't worry me though, I got straight into it. Soon I had peach juice all over my chin and dripping from my fingers. Those damn peaches were so tasty. Dad came back from putting the ladder and the box back in the shed and said, "When you're finished eating that, go to the bathroom, wash your face and hands, and you can come out for a walk with me." "Sure," I said. I'd just turned 7, I hardly ever went out for a walk just with him. When I asked if Anne and Mark were coming too, he said, "Nah, it's just you and me." "Where are we going?" I asked. "Go and have a wash and I'll tell you." When I came back out, he said, "Don't get too excited, we're just going around to Collins Street to use the public phone. If you behave yourself, you can drop the 4 pennies in and press the button for me. Can you do that?" "Easy." We had about 1/4 mile to where the phone box was. After we'd turned the first corner, John Rose Dog, a black and white mongrel, ran alongside the inside of their front fence growling at us. Dad growled back at the dog and it started barking. Dad started barking too, and I was laughing, telling him to do it some more, but he wouldn't. A bit further on, we met Mrs. Parker. She was on her way back from the deli. She peeled open the packet of Craven A's she just bought and they stood there on the footpath, having a smoke. She told Dad she was worried about her husband Jack losing his license because he'd just been pinched for drunk driving. Jack was a cab driver and she said she didn't know what they'd do after his license was taken. Dad didn't have his license either. Now, that's why we're walking up the phone box. He'd already been caught twice, I knew that. After we turned into Robert Avenue, we could see the corner deli up on our left and I knew the phone box was just around the corner. Sometimes I used to go up the deli on my own to get Dad a packet of Rothman Plain. He always let me get an ice cream cone with a change. "Can you get me an ice cream at the shop, please, Dad?" First up, he said, "Little boys that ask for things don't get any, and little boys that don't ask for things don't want any." After a long pause, he said, "Your best bet is to say nothing." But then he started smiling and he said, "Yeah, of course you can have an ice cream, but I'll make the phone call first." When we turned the corner and got to the phone box, there was a lady inside it already. We stood alongside the phone box in the sun, waiting for her to finish. She knew we were there and she kept turning around and looking at us before turning away again. But she just kept talking anyway. 10 minutes later, she was still going. When she turned the next time, Dad caught her right through the glass panel and started making out to reel in a fishing line. But the lady just turned away and carried on talking. She was still doing the same thing 5 minutes later. "Come on," Dad said, and I thought we were going home. Instead, we went into the corner deli. The bell jangled on the door when we went in and the owner came out to serve us. Dad asked if he could make me up a single cone of vanilla and the bloke winked at me and went to it straight away. While he was scooping it out, Dad said we'd been waiting on the phone for about 20 minutes. Then he walked across and looked out the shop window and said she was still going. "She'll get laryngitis," Dad said, and the man laughed. After Dad paid the man, he asked him if he'd do him a favour. The bloke then passed over a tin ham that was sitting on a shelf behind him. "Shouldn't be much more than a minute," Dad said, and I followed him out and back around to the phone box door. He knocked a couple of times and opened the door and said, "I bought this tin ham out for you. You must be starting to get hungry in there by now." The lady was off the phone in about 10 seconds flat and stormed off down Collins Street, away from us, muttering. We couldn't quite hear what she was saying. Dad took the ham back to the shop and the bloke was at the side window, still laughing. He had tears in his eyes and said, "That's the funniest bloody thing I've seen since I opened the shop." Dad made his phone call and we walked home, talking about the lady. I remember Mum laughing like mad when Dad told her what had happened. She really loved it when Dad was playful. You could tell by her laugh.
Fantastic, Jeff.
So I have got a bit of softness in me.
Yeah. Well, that's the one thing, if you read Jeff's poetry, because you can see you wouldn't describe anyone about Jeffrey being soft, but there is a tender side to him very much as well. I wouldn't mind you talking a little bit about, too, how you go about things differently depending on your audience, Jeff, like with kids and factory workers and builders and whatever.
Well, I always look at the audience and decide on the spot what I'm going to read. I don't sort of plan anything as a rule. I've got a couple of old standards like "Don't Call Me Lad" that will pull in the tough guys. And
we'll see if we can find time to fit that one in, actually.
And I've got a companion poem to that now, "Don't Look So Glum," which is about girls and their mothers. So "Don't Call Me Lad" is about the tension that exists between boys and their fathers. And I had so many girls come up to me over the years and said, "Should write a poem about girls and their mothers, because my mother..." Blah, 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 and they give me a life spill on how bad their mothers are. And I had a girl come up to me one day and at Smithfield Plains High School, not Smithfield Plains, but Mark Oliphant College, as it is now. And she wanted to buy a couple of my books, and she said, I said, "I've got some in the car." So she came out to the boot of the car and she bought a copy of Waltzing with Jack Dancer and one other book, and I autographed them for her. And she didn't have any money, and I said, "No, you can send me the money." She said, "You'll trust me?" And I said, "Of course you'll send me the money. I've got no reason not to trust you." Anyway, I said, "What's your story?" I said, "You live local, do you?" And she said, "Well, I lived around the corner." She said, "But I've had to move out because my mother is a bit of a problem." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, I came home one day." She said, "I'm in year 12. I came home one day and my laptop's gone." She said, "I've lost all my work." She said, "Mum's a junkie and she's whacked it up her arm. She's taken the computer to cash converters," and she said, "I've lost all my work." And I couldn't believe it. And she said, "You should write a poem about girls and their mothers." And really, that was the major stimulus, I think, for writing the Don't Look So Glum, where I've been able to bring that fact in and other facts too. And, you know, I've got a daughter of my own, so I've observed her with her mother. I've observed plenty of other girls with their mothers too. And I've been out at nightclubs at Cargo Club at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I've met a few mothers too who have told me how bad their daughters are. So I've had that cross-fertilisation of ideas, which, you know, has informed the poem. But
at times in your poems too, you write very much about your own life, but occasionally you write about social issues. I was wondering, would you be interested in reading Poem for Annie?
Yeah, Poem for Annie. And this is a poem that I read on building sites, a poem about my own sister who couldn't be here tonight. She's picked up a virus, but It would have been a bit of a struggle to get here from the roadway. The distance would have been a problem. But here's the poem, and I've read this poem to 100,000 building workers around Australia. I've read it in jails to men. I've read it in factories to men. It's a great poem to read to men and boys. It's a poem that's on the syllabus now at Sacred Heart College, where they're teaching a course on domestic violence. And I think it sends out a pretty strong message. Poem for Annie. In the space of 20 years, she's had three names, three husbands, and three children to remember two of them. And it's only in the past 5 years they've worked out who they are. But she knows about work. She spent a lifetime doing it, typing endless words, including these, or using others to answer phones, always too busy to check the pedigrees of those she stayed with, and they've all turned out mongrels that couldn't, wouldn't, work. They'd beat her badly in each deal, or in the middle of the night, and she looked on while friends got diamond rings and learned to hide when she got black ones. And then she met Brian, poor, poor, misunderstood Brian, who needed a mother, not a wife. But they never married, she just lived with him, till he jammed a glass into her face, smashed two teeth and slashed her lower lip. But she's laid charges now, and that's a first, but only because he showed no remorse, was what she told me. And when a second son informed that he'd found him and smashed him in the face with his motorbike helmet till he cried no more, she cried, "You'll never beat violence with violence." And it isn't just a hair that's fair. But Mum, I warned him he blackened your eye 6 months ago. I told him it wasn't a kid to tell a lie. Her stitches came out yesterday, and makeup will hide that slightly visible scar. The deeper one she's been working on with sedatives, and the crown's gone in 2 weeks' time, so I can't call a fang. And I can only hope that then she'll never be crowned again.
Oh, I heard someone just at the end of that, Jeff, I don't know who it was, but just said, "Oh, brilliant." Well, there's lots of people have thought that, and I don't know whether you know, but the Honourable Chief Justice John Doyle approved a number of Jeff's poems to be placed in courts around Australia in Jeff Cott Chambers as a piece of public art, and also they were displayed in the courts in outside of South Australia in Queensland and Tasmania as well. And one of the ones that you've written, Jeff, I think people might like to hear too, is the True Love, which deals with have you got that here?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, which deals with a pretty significant contemporary issue as well.
Yeah, this poem is on a postcard, which is on the book table at the back. There's also another postcard of monologue to a wayward niece. Monologue to a wayward niece is up in 14 courts in South Australia, in areas where you sign bail application forms for home detention. It's also on the walls of the Supreme Court of Tasmania and the Ipswich Criminal Courts. And True Love, a new poem, there's a current application for some state government funding that's being sought by the Chief Justice, the current Chief Justice, Chris Kourakos, to have this poem put on a banner and displayed on every court in South Australia and also in schools where there's kids at risk. Here's the poem. The poem is written about a boy that I met in the Ashley Youth Detention Centre in Tasmania last year. He was 13 years of age. I met him again this year at 14 years of age. He'd got out of lock up, but he was back in. I said, "What happened? You got out?" And he said, "Yeah, I got out 2 weeks before Christmas." And I said, "Was it good to get out?" "Yeah." And I said, "What'd you do when you get out?" "Oh, I went home with Mum and Nan." And I said, "Oh, so you had Christmas with Mum and Nan?" He said, "No, I fucked up. I did an aggravated carjacking and got back in again." And anyway, here's the poem that I first read about him, but that just gives you a bit of follow-up history. The poem is written too in phonetic English, so I'm working as hard as I can to make you see this boy. True Love. I met him in the education block at the Youth Training Centre. He had a mop of blonde hair, dull, lifeless eyes, and lay slumped in his seat like a seal. "I've got nothing to write about," he mumbled. "Write about what you're in here for," I suggested. He rolled the puppy fat resting on his shoulders and said, "This is just for robbing a store." You're kidding me, son. How old are you? I'm 13. And how did all this go down? I went in the servo with a pair of scissors and said, give us your money. But the bloke, he just laughed at me. Made me angry, so I thought I'd try and kill him. I swung at his throat, but he moved back and I couldn't get my arm in far enough because of the bars. Then I had to back off. I had to go for the door. The coppers got me just down the road. I really didn't know what I was doing. I'd been on the ice and boost for 5 days. I just really want to get out now so I can get back on the ice. Oh, I love it. And that's what we're up against, you know, like right around the nation. I used to think heroin was a bad drug in the 70s and 80s. Beautiful drug, you know, compared to ice.
Some of you may not know, Jeff, you might like to comment too. Jeff has made a decision not to, you don't drink.
I don't drink. I've never had a drink in my life because of my upbringing. Yeah. I did smoke dope for about 15 years, but I realised after 15 years of smoking dope that it was kid stuff, you know, and I was using it to run away from facing reality. So I stopped and, you know, never looked back. If I had my life over again, you know, I would live my life a little bit differently to how I've lived it because I wouldn't smoke either. I wouldn't smoke cigarettes and I wouldn't smoke dope. I'd still be a non-drinker because I think that I had two brothers. They're both younger brothers. They're both deceased. And, you know, booze is a big contributor to their demise. So we make our choices, and these are the sorts of things that I talk to kids about in schools and in youth detention centres and other places where I run into young people that are living difficult lives. And I tell them about, you know, hard decisions that I made as a young person. And, you know, for a 69-year-old man, a person of my vintage, not to be drinking at 18, you know, what was I, a pufter, you know, like, I'd still go into pubs, but, you know, I'd have a lemon squash and, you know, people would try and give me a hard time. I'd say, fucking come out of the car park and fucking sort this out, you know. So I was never shy to stand up for my rights to make my own decisions, and I think that's important too. Yeah.
Jeff, you've talked a little bit about your dad during a little bit today, but he had a big influence on you, I think. You've written some stuff about the influence your dad's had.
He was the biggest influence, and I wrote a poem for his funeral, and I note that we've got a lady in the audience tonight who, Gail Barry, who's driven down from Clare tonight, but her auntie passed away in Semaphore only a couple of months ago, and her auntie had left a message with people that she wanted me to read my Semaphore poem at her funeral, and I've written, and this man in the front row expects me to be writing a poem for his funeral. The pressure is on. He hasn't even died, and you know, but he's got the request in. But I do write poems for people's funerals too. And when my father was dying, we knew that he was dying because he too had cancer. He was a big smoker as well as a big drinker. And I'd go and see him at the hospice, and I'd go home and walk around the block at Semaphore thinking about him and coming up with some great lines for a poem, but I thought I can't commit them to the page. I've got to wait until he expires and then I can write the poem. So I held as much as I could in my head. I saw him at midnight, was told that he mightn't last the night, but we went home to have a rest and recover. And I got a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning to say he'd fallen off the perch. I got up and wrote the poem by mid-morning. I was at my mother's place reading it to my mother, one brother and sister. My mother wanted to edit some of the lines out, but I said, you know, funerals call for honesty. We've got to be honest. Here's the poem. You can be the judge. Poem for Johnny. There's no more talking underwater without blowing bubbles. Captain Hornblower is dead. There's no more medication, no more nebulizers, no more oxygen masks, no more calling out for Lois, no more calling out for Mum. John, for you, there's no more pain and there's no more oxygen. And life was a gas, John, wasn't it? Well, much of it. Like the woman you chose for a life partner after an 8-day romance. 51 years plus. Now, John, that's a gas. John, you're a good bloke and a pest. No, this is not an occasion for lies or concealment. The truth of the matter is, your good always outweighed your bad. You gave everyone an even break, John. I can remember a childhood where you'd often bring home someone who was hungry or homeless and would share whatever was needed. You walked it like you talked it, John. You were never a hypocrite. And through that childhood around the kitchen table, you showed us how to act. Sometimes you turned into the theatre of the absurd, but you talked a lot of sense too. If you had any air in those clapped out lungs today, you'd have likely yelled out, nonsense. You taught us much about wordplay. Yeah, you'd play, John, and you'd play up too. And it's debatable what you'd enjoy the most. You knew no shame. I have a very pleasant memory of you one sunny day in maybe 1965. You'd asked me to meet you in King William Street, outside a bank, at a particular time. I was early and looked each way continually, until our eyes met from over 50 yards. And though the street was crowded, you shut out everyone except me. You were stone cold sober at the time, but you still made a game of it. You crept from hiding behind one no parking sign to the next, advancing on me step by step in your suit and snap brim hat, oblivious to bending necks. I was a bit embarrassed for a moment, and then I saw the looks from some of those watching eyes. They were children's eyes and adults' heads. And yeah, you made me realise the value of play. We laughed. I think we always laughed a lot. We laughed back then that we'd never cremate you. We reckoned with all the St. Agnes brandy you'd put away, you'd burn a soft blue flame forever. Sort of like the colour of your eyes. Well, it's come down to this, John. Now listen, Captain, it's absolute. We're going to have to put that to the test.
Jeff, while you're now, on that team...
1997, I reckon there'd still be a soft blue flame out at Enfield now.
Could I get you to read another poem, which is the other end of the spectrum, a much more tender one about your daughter Grace, who's here in the audience tonight.
Sure.
And Grace herself, of course, was a very successful writer as well. And I think won the Somerset National Novella Competition, Grace. So congratulations from all of us on that. And I do remember Grace as a little girl, because when Jeff came down to Mount Gambier one time when I was down there, we were sitting around after at the end of the day talking about things, and Jeff was talking very fondly about you, Grace. And so I went home and grabbed a box of books and brought them up to Jeff, and he hung on to them. I think it must have been a few years later when I collected them.
And I reckon we had them for a couple of years, and Red is Best was the favourite, and I got that for Grace for her 25th year of celebrating Christmas. I found it on Google and got a copy of Red is Best and surprised the hell out of her on her Christmas day in a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Isn't that a great story about the power of reading too?
Yeah.
I remember Ray Bradbury said you don't have to burn, remember he wrote Fahrenheit 451 about the book burning and the Nazis, and he said something like you don't have to actually burn the books to destroy a culture, you've just got to stop people reading them. And I think Jeff spent his life doing the opposite. There's a lot of kids reading stuff and engaging in poetry in a way they wouldn't have without him. Let's hear Grace.
It is 35 degrees Celsius and my 5-year-old daughter, Grace, has just come home from school wearing a blue check uniform, brown sandals, and a heat flush. The house is shrouded in darkness. She draws the vertical blinds on the picture window overlooking St. Vincent Gulf, looks out across the esplanade, and says, in a deadpan voice, "The sea is as flat as my chest." Less than a month at school, and already she has mastered metaphor.
We're running out of time, I know, but could I just talk a little bit to the one you've got here, Jeff, the one Waltzing with Jack Dancer. A lot of you probably know that poem. It's the story of the very long and successful battle you've had with cancer.
That's right.
And one of the poems I've run off here, it's a 7 or 8 pager, you can't read it, but it's called The Seventh Doctor, which is about his, a lot of you probably know it, it's about his time at, in hospital and how he was treated by the different people. But maybe we can have a shorter one, or maybe we can have maybe.
Well, let's have an uncertain future.
Okay.
As a wind-up
sure.
poem.
Yep.
Because we all have uncertain futures. There is no certainty for any of us. I'm planning to have a 70th birthday on the 21st of September, but that's about as far as my forward planning goes. You know, I'm not planning the 80th just yet. But I wrote this poem. I was going to have lunch with Chris Caracas one day and driving through Victoria Square, and as I'm driving through the square, I noticed a rather attractive woman. I was just seeing a rear view of her, and she had a micro mini skirt on, and suntan, and a very skimpy little top. Wasn't very much clothing on the woman at all, you know. And I had a look, and I thought I should be concentrating on my driving. So I drove through the square and ignored trying to have another look. And when I got to the traffic lights at Goodger Street to make a right-hand turn, she had walked across the square, and she was now standing 10 feet away from me at the traffic lights waiting to cross. I'd seen her before from a rear view. Now I was seeing her in a side elevation, and this woman, while she had a micro mini skirt on, was around about 7 months pregnant. And I would have liked to have wound down the window and said, I think you need to go home and tell mummy to show you how to get dressed. But I thought that would be a bit cheeky, and I'm certainly not a cheeky person or combative. But the next thing, she starts dragging on a cigarette, and I thought, my God, you know, like, what chance has this unborn fetus got, let alone her? And I was probably 12 months into my recovery. I pulled the car around the corner, got out the car, and ran into Bill Braithwaite, who came up and started cross-examining me about whether I was going to live. And I said, listen, Bill, I bought new shoes, I bought new clothes, shut up, you know, like, I don't know how long I'm going to live for. No one knows. And I went home and wrote this poem called An Uncertain Future, which was a poem that appeared on the wall of Jeffcott Chambers a few years ago at the invitation of John Doyle, the Chief Justice. An Uncertain Future. I was sitting in my car opposite the Adelaide Magistrates Court, waiting on a change of lights when I first saw her. She was in her early 20s, had on a black sleeveless top and a denim miniskirt. Her arms and legs were heavily tanned, and she wore strappy sandals. Her hair was bottled blonde, and as she crossed in front of me, blowing out a stream of blue cigarette smoke, I noticed her black roots complemented her chipped and broken front teeth. She was at least 7 months pregnant. The lights changed. I moved off slowly into my own uncertain future.
We've got the wrap up. We're getting the wrap up. Look, we're about to have a wrap up, but I think it's been a wonderful night. Jeff, could you just indulge me? This is one of my really favourite ones. Can we have one more poem?
Yes.
Okay. Finding Myself. Do you mind reading that one?
No, I can.
You got it there?
I've got it here in the book.
I think I kind of like it because I think Jeff, having watched him over the years with kids, he's helped a lot of kids actually find themselves.
And this poem was published in the 2009 Best Australian Poems. At 50 plus, the morning shave was invariably something I did from a distance, standing in the shower alcove 3 metres across the bathroom from the mirror to squint at a rough reflection of my father, confident that I knew the contours of my face and neck, always careful to avoid the sebaceous cyst below my right earlobe, the one that always proved a mountain could be made out of a molehill if I passed over it with the triple blade a touch too heavy, always having to make sure the tiny bump of a scar below my lip didn't get too close and turn the shaving cream red and cause me to snarl and swear. But now at 58, with a major neck dissection done 2 weeks ago, the left side of my neck muscle removed, the 30 metal staples gone, the scar starting to heal, I find myself frosting the mirror with my own breath. My cheeks now sallow and slack after surgery, still too tentative, even with my glasses on, to sweep away the morning stubble. And once again I'm a young boy, my strokes deliberate and planned, while in the mirror my father's blue eyes squint and watch every move. Thank you. It's a ripper.